We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
My name is Suki Jones, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 1st, 2000, and that was not my first attempt at trying to get sober. I had many failed attempts at recovery before that day, and I honestly did not think that I would get sober that day. It was one more attempt that I was going to make and just try to see, you know, I was hoping that it would take, of course, and really that attempt was me thinking that I could just straighten my life out for a little bit. Like, I just wanted to kind of reboot a little bit and refresh. And I had no intention of staying sober for 24 years. And here I am. So in traditional format, I will talk a little bit about what it was like, how I came to 12-step, and what my life is like now. I grew up in the Midwest, and I had an alcoholic parent. And my father was a violent alcoholic, but not all the time. So growing up for me was, I was an only child. And so I was really hesitant to bring, you know, like I didn't have siblings to like bounce off, like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening again. Or I can't believe there was nobody real, no real sounding board. So I had kind of a, I felt very lonely as a child, and I felt uncomfortable bringing kids back to my house because I didn't know which version of my dad I was going to get, and I certainly didn't know which version of my dad my friends might get. So I tried to spend a lot of time at friends' houses and just didn't really want anybody to know too much about my family because it was hard for me to navigate as a kid. And so my dad's alcoholism escalated. He also was a compulsive cheater. He was constantly having affairs with teachers of mine and other people in town, and, you know, just always cheating on my mom. So what ended up happening was he met someone that shared his love for alcohol, but also was into drugs. And so his alcoholism progressed where he was drinking and using a lot. And he started to get really paranoid. He chose to leave my mom at this point. And my parents had split up a few times. And so it was kind of always split up. My mom and I would come out to California for a little while, and then we'd go back. Things would get bad with my parents in the Midwest, and then we'd leave, and we'd come to California, and then we'd go back. And this time, though, the woman that he met, they were doing a lot of drugs and drinking to excess, and my dad decided at that point that he wanted to put a hit on my mom. And so my mom and I left the state pretty quickly and came out to California to live temporarily with her parents. When that happened, my dad got in contact with the courts in the state because my mom had taken me out of state without his permission. And so he got the courts involved because my mom had no recourse. She didn't have anything to like prove that this hit had been taken out on her. And so I was sent back to the state. And at that point, my dad and his girlfriend at the time were plotting to kidnap me. And I was catching tidbits of conversations with them, saying terrible things about my mother. And it was a lot to navigate as a small kid. And they began to, so I'm 8 years old at this point, or eight and a half. And at this point, they began to drug me. And this was all something they had, you know, part of their plan to kidnap me. I was able to get a hold of my mother, though, and the courts were brought in. And I was sent back to, sent to California, back to my mom. And we were living with her parents. And then, you know, after that, California was my home. My dad didn't speak to me for almost 2 decades after the court hearing because he blamed me for testifying against him, which, you know, like as an adult now, I look at it and I'm like, that is some alcoholic logic right there. Like he blamed the 8-year-old daughter for getting him into trouble when he was the one that was threatening my mother with violence and threatening to kidnap me. So my mother and I then were living in California in the Bay Area. I turned 9 that summer at my grandparents' house. And my mom was trying to find work and trying to readjust as a single parent. And during that time living at my grandparents' house, my grandfather began to sexually assault me. I really, like, at that time, I felt I couldn't believe that I had, even as a 9-year-old, I remember very clearly thinking, I can't believe this is happening. I left this situation that was really hard as a kid and was really relieved that we were leaving the state and that you're starting this new life. And I was very excited about like having this new life in California. And I felt pretty like ripped off. I remember just being like, I can't believe this. And it went on for a number of years that my grandfather was sexually assaulting me. My mother and I ended up moving out of the house eventually, not because of that, but because my mother didn't know. Once my mom got a little money accrued and we were able to get our own house, we moved out, but the assault didn't stop then. Because I was a young kid and my mom was then working long hours to keep a roof over our head and food on the table. And so she had set up that my grandfather, who got off work early, would pick me up after school at our new house. So it was just like a constant source of stress and trauma and just me not knowing how to cope with anything that I had encountered in my life so far. It was really hard for me to deal with any of it. And I didn't know how to process it. I didn't know how to deal with it. I was afraid to tell. I don't think I told any friend of mine that it was happening until about 2 years into it. And then I did tell a neighbor kid and she told her mom, and her mom was like kind of dismissive about it and just like, oh, well, she was kind of like, well, oh, that's terrible. but nothing happened. So the abuse went on for a while. And then when I got into junior high, there was an incident where my grandfather wasn't supposed to, it was my first year in junior high. And so I was in seventh grade. My grandfather would normally have picked me up after school at my house. And my mom had said, you're not going with him today. I'm coming, you know, grandpa's not going to pick you up. I'm going to come home early. So I was at my house and this has all been worked out. And I hear the keys in the front door of my house. And I had reached a point where I just knew that I couldn't do it. I couldn't take it one more time. I just could not do it. And so when he became physical with me, I attacked him and he made all kinds of threats that he would the threats were that, one, he was going to tell my mother, which he absolutely wasn't going to do and didn't do. He also threatened that he was going to have me sent back to my dad, which he absolutely didn't do and would have never done. But these were, you know, I'm like 12, 13 at that time. And I was terrified because why wouldn't you be when somebody's threatening you with these kind of things? And they've been abusing you, like you, you know, but I couldn't do it anymore. And so that was, I didn't know that would be the last time. I was in great fear for months, kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop, thinking like, oh my God, is today the day that, you know, I'm going to be sent back to my dad, or, you know, like, I just really thought that he was going to make good on those promises. And of course he never did, because he didn't want to be found out. That happened to coincide with me finding the group of kids at school that were the field kids, the kids that hung, the like stoners and the party kids. And in some ways, I think because I had found those kids, I think maybe, and I hadn't really started partying too much, partying quote unquote, by that point, I had been given a prescription for a narcotic because I was on a synchronized swim team and had pulled a muscle. So I was kind of toying around, like playing a little bit, taking the pills when my mom wasn't home, taking little sips of alcohol and shots and stuff when my mom wasn't home. So there was that going on. And then when I found this group of kids at school that were kind of doing the same thing, you know, stealing pills from their parents' medicine cabinet and smoking pot in the field and going to parties and all that, it just all kind of coincided. And in some ways, I think that group of friends helped me to having that group of friends and realizing that drugs and alcohol were another outlet kind of gave me this courage to stand up against my grandfather, which is kind of a weird thing, but the two things did intersect. So I started partying and hanging out with the party kids all the time at that point. And my grandfather was now, you know, I was still seeing him every day, but he wasn't, it was like it never happened. Like he never tried anything again. He never, you know, there was never a word spoken about it between us. It was gaslighting, you know, like it was like, it didn't happen. And sometimes it did make me feel kind of crazy because I was like, wait, did that really happen? Like I'm in the car with him right now and we're just listening to the radio driving down the road. And there's no mention of it. So it was hard to reconcile those things. And I really started to lean into using drugs and alcohol to kind of just put that all behind me. Like I used drugs and alcohol as a tool to kind of just blot out all the memories that I had of my dad and my grandfather. And it worked for a little while. That was a coping mechanism for me. And I really used that so that I wasn't thinking about all the trauma I had incurred. So as I got into high school, I started partying more. I started partying where it wasn't the thing. I never liked smoking pot. And so I really wanted to like smoking pot because I wanted to escape and I wanted to just be obliterated. I never ever drank just to have a drink. I wanted to be destroyed. I wanted to be I didn't want to have a memory of what happened. I wanted it always to be to excess, just whatever I could do, I would do. So I would drink and take pills. And then the summer before I went into high school, I went to a party with some older friends and I was introduced to cocaine. And the moment the first time I did cocaine, I was like, oh, this is it. Where has this drug been? All I wanted to do was continue that feeling. As soon as I did coke, I was like, okay, like I need vodka. I need wine coolers were a thing back then. I would just, you know, go through wine coolers like nobody's business. If I had vodka, if I had wine coolers and I had cocaine, like I was so happy. That was my go-to thing for a long while. Even at that point in my life, I had a lot of mental health issues. I would later be diagnosed as bipolar, but earlier on, my mom just didn't know what was going on with me. But I, as I just mentioned, had a lot of mental health things going on. Even when we lived in the Midwest, I was having anxiety where I would refuse to get out of my mom's car at school drop off, or just like having these, like where I would be just so depressed and so anxious as a little kid. And then as I got into junior high and high school, those feelings kind of like the volume went up on them. And it would be again, like where I just couldn't go to school. Freshman year in high school was like, it became a big problem, like where I would not be able to go to school at all. I just couldn't leave the house, almost like agoraphobia, but it was very anxiety laden, which is interesting because I'm a super extroverted person, very social, but I also was terrified of leaving the house. And the way I dealt with that was by using and drinking. So I ended up dropping, I ended up dropping out of high school. But before that happened, I had a suicide attempt. I had a couple suicide attempts and was hospitalized and tried to go back to high school after that. And there were a group of girls that had found out that I had been in the psych facility. And I was also cutting at the time. These girls really, really bullied me and really made it really, really uncomfortable for me at school, to the point where I was like, I can't do this anymore. And really, I was only going to school to like socialize and to like make connections with people so that I could drink and use the way that I wanted to. Like, I just want to know where the party is. So that was my main reason for going to school, or to entice other people to like cut classes with me so that I could go drink and use somebody else's drugs. And so I ended up dropping out of high school. I got a job at Tower Records, which was a great place for somebody that liked to drink and do drugs. It was really fun. It, you know, was all rock and roll and backstage passes and all the fun things that you would imagine working for a record store. It was all of that. Lots of partying. I got pregnant with my daughter, and I had a little girl, and then very quickly right after that I got pregnant with my son. I was young and had two small kids, and I was partying. I was the only, you know, I was the only person of my friends that had kids at all, and I was not really prepared to be a mother, and that had its own challenges. I had also started modeling when I was in high school. After my kids were born, I went back into modeling. Much like Tower Records, it was a great place, modeling, and I did some acting also, and those were both great places if you wanted to do drugs and drink a lot. It was very conducive to that sort of lifestyle. I mean, in all honesty, I had a lot of fun in those years until I didn't. There were some really great times, and you know, people say your worst day sober is better than your best day out there. And I don't know that that's true, because I had some really great days, but I will say that the worst days when I was still drinking and using were horrific. And today I don't have those days. Nothing is so bad today that drugs and alcohol can absolutely not make worse in my life. That's what I would say about that. So I had two young kids. I was modeling and acting, and I had a lot of friends that were musicians and a lot of friends that were in bands, and I had, you know, like a lot of friends that were still part of the Tower Records scene, music buyers and people that worked for Sony and Warner Brothers and that sort of thing. And so there were a lot of parties and a lot of opportunities to do drugs for someone. I just kept partying the way that I had, but I had kids now. And so my group of friends started, this was in the 90s. And so in my group of friends, heroin came on the scene, and it came on really strong. And all of my friends were doing heroin. And so, of course, absolutely, I want to try heroin. And so I started doing heroin with friends. And at first, and immediately, it was much the same as the cocaine experience that I had in, you know, like when I was like 13. The first time I did it, it was like falling in love. And it was everything that I needed and everything that I wanted. And it filled me up completely, to the point where I was completely lost in myself. And lost in my life and out of control. Heroin took over my entire life. I really, you know, luckily did not have a lot of consequences from my heroin use early on. I should say also that prior to finding heroin, I was doctor shopping. And I had gotten a prescription. I had gotten a narcotic prescription from a doctor, not even doctor shopping at first. It was like offered to me like, hey, like, oh, sounds like you're having tension headaches. And a doctor recommended, was like, oh, I'll give you a prescription for this. And I was like, sure. So I had a running prescription before I started using heroin. I had a running prescription for a narcotic. I had a running prescription for Valium, and I had a running prescription for Xanax. And when I say running prescription, I mean like they were filling it, you know, like giving me hundreds of tablets every single month. In the very beginning, when I was getting at it, it was great. And then, you know, like the duration of how long I had those, how long they were still in my cabinet became shorter and shorter and shorter. So, you know, like, because if you're doing a little heroin on the weekends, it's not going to stay like that. And so what started happening was that I was drinking daily. And within a year, I am a full-blown junkie. It was not a good time. You know, it was not happy or without chaos. It was all the incomprehensible demoralization you can think of. And, you know, when you have someone that you're in a relationship with and you're both using, like it's, you know, like, I don't know. I couldn't get sober or even think about getting sober while I was in a relationship with him. Because one of us, even if we wanted to even if one of us wanted to get sober, you know, it was like, you're not just trying to get one person sober, you're trying to get two people sober. And if one person falls off, then the other one's going to follow suit. We just couldn't make it work. There were, I don't even know how many cold turkey attempts at trying to kick that just, you know, like where I just thought, you know, I'm never going to stop because I can't get past 3 days. There was maybe a week or 10 days where I would, you know, not be drinking and using, and then I would just go back to it. And it was, you know, it was horrific. You think there's no escape. Prior to that particular boyfriend, I had been with someone that that I was partying with, and that boyfriend ended up dying in a fatal accident. When I was at his funeral, someone in my group of friends was at that funeral and made a comment to me. She said, "You don't have to live like this." And I felt like she could see right through me. And it scared me a little bit. Like I was like, oh shit, like she's like, I have a problem and she's on to me. Cause I really felt like nobody could tell how bad I was except for when I started dating the next person and like we were using together. Obviously, we both knew how bad it was. I was hiding it from my family, I was hiding it from my kids, although my kids were very little and do have memories of me being knotted out, me being bloodied, and not being able to wake me, and that's a hard thing to deal with. That's a hard thing to know that your kids have that memory. And I'll get back to that. But the woman that I had ran into at the funeral, I kept seeing. So I was in this other relationship, and I was with this guy, and we are both using, and we're both drinking. And we're both just wrecks. We're just struggling. And I kept running into this person. She started working at a coffee shop that I went to. And she kept like giving me little morsels of hope. She looked like, the thing was, even at the funeral when I had run into her, she looked like a different person than the person I had known. She looked shiny. She looked vibrant. She looked like she had life back in her. She just had something going on where I was like, wow, like, how do you do that? Like, I was just baffled by like how she was carrying herself that way. And I was also really skeptical that anybody was really sober. I just couldn't believe that people were really sober. But I kept running into this woman, and eventually I asked her about the meetings she went to. I was really, really resistant to the idea of going to any 12-step meeting because my dad had tried to go to 12-step a few times, you know, when I was a kid. There's a story that I tell in my book. I wrote a book, and in my book, I talk about this, how when my dad was like on the wagon, there was this Serenity Prayer plaque that hung up in our house. And when he was off the wagon and he was drinking, the plaque was nowhere to be seen. My dad was like the template for what I saw, what I thought an alcoholic, what an addict, what, like, I was like, well, 12 step doesn't work. It didn't work for my dad, you know? So why would it work? I just didn't think it would work, but she was kind of proving that idea wrong. I didn't know what else to do. I had started a methadone program with the boyfriend that I was with at that time. So I was on I had been on methadone a few times and done like a 28-day taper, 20, 21 day, 20. I can't even remember now. I think it was 28-day taper, but never gotten through it. And the counselor at the methadone clinic said to me, why don't you try actually doing the thing? Like, why don't you go on maintenance until you can get your shit together, start going to 12 step and get rid of your boyfriend? And I was like, what? That's a lot. That's a lot to do. My life was such a mess. And between my counselor at the clinic and this woman who ended up becoming a very good friend of mine, who I really just knew just through mutual friends. We weren't close at all by any means. I just kept running into her and she kept giving me the morsels, you know? So it's like, okay, yeah, I'll check out some 12 step. And I really didn't think I would, but I told my methadone clinic counselor I would. And so I got some names of meetings from this woman, and I begrudgingly, like I had the list that she gave me for a little while, just kind of like tucked away in my wallet. And there was a night that my mom took the kids, and I decided, like, I was like, okay, I'm gonna go check out the freaking AA bullshit. So I went. It was actually an NA meeting. It wasn't an AA meeting, although I've done both programs and go back and forth to both. I went to the meeting and had no intention of going back. I really thought, like, okay, I'll go check it out and then I can say I did it. But by that night, I had just broken up or was breaking up with the boyfriend that I had. And so I went to the meeting and I got about 25 minutes into the meeting. And I was like, okay, I'm good. I'm out of here. And so I went to leave the meeting and I made it to the front steps of the church and somebody came out after me. It was this guy who ended up being a really good friend of mine. He said, why don't you just come back in just for the end? He's like, just come back in until the end. And I was like, okay. Because, you know, like, what am I going to say? No. I mean, I could have, but I didn't. So I went back in, and in the last 20 minutes of the meeting, I heard a woman tell her story, and it was very similar to mine. She'd had similar things in her childhood. She was a single parent. There were enough things that I identified with that I started bawling. Like I started the tears just spilled out of me. And two women in the meeting came over and sat down by me. All these people gave me their phone numbers after. And literally the people in that group, this was Oakland Narcotics Anonymous Fellowship. And they wouldn't leave me alone. Like they just would not leave me alone. And I'm grateful like every day that they didn't. And I know a lot of those people still today, like I see them all the time in meetings and I'm so grateful that they, you know, just were there for me and that they just, not only that they wouldn't give up on me, but they don't give up on anybody. And like, if you go to a meeting and you don't find what you need there, or you don't find the people that you resonate with there, go to another meeting. Because I can guarantee you that eventually, if you go to enough meetings, you're going to find your people. And I tell newcomers that all the time. I'm like, you hate AA? I understand. I get it. You hate NA? I get it. I've been there. There's been lots of times I haven't liked meetings. There's been lots of times I haven't liked 12 step. But I keep going because the people in the meeting, it's principles over personalities. I don't like everybody in the meeting. I don't like every meeting. But regardless of how I'm feeling on a particular day about AA or 12-step or the meetings or a person or the way somebody does something, it doesn't matter because those people are going to support me either way. And I'm here today because they did and because we're stronger together than we are apart. And I think that's really all I got, but I will say, keep coming back because it does work.
Thank you, Suki.
Thank you.
What does your program look like today, 24 years in?
It's a lot different than when I first started. I mean, it is and it isn't. I kind of go back and forth between Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, although like they're both always in my life. It's just I tend to do one a little more than the other at any given time. But I think it's not any different than like when a meeting, you know, like I can go to a meeting, like I can go to my home group meeting tonight or not tonight, on Monday night, I can go to my home group meeting and I know pretty much what I'm going to get out of that meeting. But it's there's a constant there, but meetings over time change. So in 6 months, my home group meeting might not feel the same to me as it did tomorrow night. And when I feel like it doesn't feel the same or it's not fitting the same or it's not working for me the same, I switch it up. Over the years, I've learned just to be fluid about it. And if I'm not getting what I need out of a meeting, go to a different meeting. Like there's so many, and you know, like I'm here in the Bay Area, so there's hundreds of meetings and I'm really lucky that that's the case. And there's online meetings. I can go to a meeting in Hollywood. So I'm pretty open to just being willing. If one thing isn't working for me, try something different. Ask another AA, ask my sponsor, just stay open.
I wonder if that's because you're an extrovert, because the idea of mixing it up that much. Oh, no, I don't want to do that. I'm just a creature of habit. I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Maybe because I'm very social. So I think it's funny because there's parts of me that I want the familiarity and I'm like, no, I want to be at my home group and I want it to be this way and I want it to feel like this and I want so-and-so to be there. You know, like I want kind of like controlling things like in my will, but then I'm like, okay, like stay open because I just have faith that what I need will come to me if I'm open about it. I really want to do the things that I do and keep my little habits and routines, but I also want to check out other things because there's things out there. If I go to a NA meeting that I don't usually go to, or even an AA meeting in San Jose or something, I may get something that I'm not expecting out of it. So I'm open to the possibility that like, good things are going to happen. And that if I am open to receiving those good things, it's all the more better. Hmm.
Said like a city girl to a suburban lady. What is the biggest difference between, or some of the differences rather, between NA and AA?
No. I don't, it's really kind of in the language, I think. But it's funny because when I was in early recovery, I did predominantly NA. And I know the woman friend that I was talking about that got me, that 12-stepped me into the meetings, like she would be like, okay, let's go to a meeting. It would be an AA meeting. And I really, this is something else I should point out, is like, I had a really, really hard time identifying as an alcoholic because my dad was an alcoholic and I didn't want to be anything like my dad. So I was like, oh, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm an addict. and then, you know, like then I'd go to AA meetings and I'd be like, I am an alcoholic. You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what it is. I'm going to use it alcoholically. It can be cupcakes. It can be vodka. It's the way I use the way I do things that's alcoholic. So I think for me, like the difference in NA and AA is just, it's mostly just wording in the meetings, really. Like I don't, there, and then it may be different in other parts of the country, but I think especially because I have been to other meetings in other places and I'm like, oh, they do this different, like way different. But I think they're pretty similar in the Bay Area, where they are more interchangeable, just a little different format and the language. The program is recovery. So I just try to look at the similarities and not the differences.
Yeah. I didn't know until I started recording these that a lot of people that I would have thought should be in NA or just would be in NA. If you have primarily a drug problem, you'd be in NA, and alcohol, you'd be in AA. And my mother, who died of the disease and her drug of choice was not alcohol, couldn't stand NA meetings. And I just wish she would have known, oh, you should have tried AA meetings. But she just so didn't identify for the exact same reason, because her parents were alcoholics, her ex-husband, she wasn't an alcoholic. But in fact, perhaps she wouldn't have died of this disease, and she could have found some recovery if she had more of an open mind like you.
I think that's where really just staying open to the possibilities that you'll get something out of it if you're open and willing.
How old were you and how old were your kids when you got, I guess you got clean and sober at the same time. Did you stop drinking before you thought you were not? Okay.
My kids were little. My kids were really little. I would kind of like set them in the corner of the meeting and just be like keeping an eye on them. And then as they got into elementary school and stuff, I would bring them to meetings. There were meetings like my kids had, my daughter in particular has told me, oh yeah, there were meetings that I definitely liked better because there were like, there's still meetings on Howe Street in Oakland, and they have like a little kitchen. And so my kids like sitting in the kitchen, coloring and doing their homework and stuff while I was in the meeting. And I think they also had the keys and stuff at that meeting. So that was probably enticing for them also. Yeah.
How is your mental health today?
It's stable. For the most part, I've talked about this on podcasts and just in speaking engagements. I had terrible depression, like many people did, like during the pandemic. But my depression got to a point where I actually became agoraphobic and could not, like I talked about, like I had as a young kid, where I just couldn't leave the house. I had that during the early part of the pandemic. I was terrified to leave my house. I couldn't do it. And it was really awful. And it was honestly the closest I've ever come to the idea of relapsing, like where I was like, I can't take this. Like, I don't know what else to do. And I felt so isolated, and I'm not super tech savvy. I have like a very, a very particular skill set of, if it's creative and I'm doing it with a computer, that's one thing, but like Zoom meetings and all of that sort of thing, I was just like, I don't know how to do this. I feel disconnected. I feel disengaged. So that was really, really hard for me. And really, it was really scary. It was a scary place. Because I don't know that I would have drank or used, but it was definitely the closest I've felt to really wanting to do it in my entire recovery. Yeah, so I worked out my meds with my doctor and upped my time with my therapist and like, you know, got through it. But it was very much like very dark time for me.
Do you feel like your relationship with your higher power changed during that time? Damn it. That was the whole reason. The answer is yes, of course.
I mean, not, I don't think so, really, because, like, for me, like, the church, not that I'm super religious, but I am super spiritual, has always been sort of something that I find comfort in. And so even, like, in those dark times, like, that was probably something that did pull me through, is, like, I was like, there is a higher reason to this, and it's going to be okay, and I'm going to be taken care of. And, like, I think if I didn't have that connection or that belief in a higher power, I think it really would have been a lot harder, or, you know, like, or I might have used or drank, you know? So I don't know that my relationship with my higher power changed, but I think it, I really relied on that relationship, because, like, it was as tangible as my relationship with people, you know, like, it was like, I can't touch it. It's not here. But I have to believe in it. Like, I have to know that it's there and it's going to be okay.
Fair enough. I'll take that. I'll take that.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, how do I explain that?
No, you did a really good job. You really did a good job. I didn't know where you were going with that, but I get what you were saying for sure. I followed. You did a good job. My question was implying, and I, it was not a good question. So if I had more editing skills, I'd go back and redo my question and fix it. But I have two more questions for you, and then I'll let you off.
Yeah.
Okay. You said you didn't talk to your dad for 20 years. Did something happen?
Something happened with him. He ended up getting sober. And so he met a woman, and she was involved with the church. And I think from what I understand, she was kind of like, well, if you're going to be with me, you have to give up the alcohol. And so he started going to church with her and gave up drinking. And I don't know, it was bittersweet, because we started to form a relationship for really the first time in both of our lives. Like, we actually had a relationship where both of us were sober and, you know, really working on having some sort of bond. And he was diagnosed with cancer, which went really quickly. And so we were able to become close, but then he died. So it was sad, but I will say that I got to be at his bedside. I got to go back to the Midwest and be at his bedside when he passed. And I don't know that I could have done that if I weren't sober. And I don't know that he would have ever reached out to me if he weren't sober. So, I mean, that's, to me, like, that is the gift of recovery right there for both of us, was that we were able to, like, repair not all the damage, because, you know, it was rough. Like, he was, you know, not a nice person when he was drunk. And I have some really terrible memories from childhood. And, but I understand also that, like, he was in the grips of his alcoholism and addiction when I was a kid, you know? So I have compassion that, you know, the person that I got to spend time with at the end of his life is not the same person. That he was a different person, and that I'm just grateful that I got that, and that we have that.
Final question.
Yeah.
For the alcoholic or addict out there listening, still suffering, what would you like to leave them with?
I would say, do not give up, because I don't know how many times I do not know how many times I tried to get sober, and I couldn't do it. And I thought that I'm doomed. I thought that this is how I'm going to die. this is, you know, like I had dreams or nightmares at the end of my using and drinking that like I would dream that like the Grim Reaper was coming for me. And I would dream that like my kids were going to be left without a mom. And it was horrific. And I just like, I hope that everyone that is struggling or that is living in that much fear can just find the tiniest bit of faith and know that there is something better out there for you. And you just have to keep going. And that if you just have faith in the program and keep going and keep trying and don't stop, your life will get better.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.